Although we are receding further and further away in time from the time of Christian origins, we are ironically coming to know more and more about them. An army of scholars are closely examining the New Testament texts, are analysing recent archaeological discoveries, and are digging deep into the documents of the ancient world to produce a composite picture which is increasingly accurate and reliable about what the early Christian communities were like. It was a surprise to me to learn a few years ago at a conference that, in fact, the church at Corinth, on which Paul expends so much controversial energy, may well have consisted of only about 25 people. And forget about them worshipping in a building like this. They would have been in a room about the size of a large modern suburban house, eyeballing each other across that room. At the end of his life and ministry, Paul could look back on having founded a series of modestly sized communities scattered across the Mediterranean world, none of them probably bigger than this parish. What then are we to make of those words of Jesus in Mark's Gospel this morning, what's called the Markan Apocalypse, about the end of the age, and how does that relate to these early Christian communities? Well, at one level, Jesus was a prophet, and he's accurately predicting what would happen several decades after his death, because the world that Jesus knew came completely to an end because of the events of AD 70 and the disastrous revolt against Roman rule that initiated a war lasting 3.5 years. The Galilean villages and lakeside towns that Jesus knew so well were the first to experience the scorched earth policy of the reinvading Roman legions. Then there were high priestly families, the Sadducees, those who ran the temple and who'd made an accommodation with Rome. They were wiped out either by the revolutionary insurgents or by the reinvading legions. Then there were the hotheads who had started all the trouble in the first place, the zealots and the nationalists. They fought to the last man and were wiped out. And the Essenes and the utopian religious communities on the fringe of the Jewish religious world, they died when the Roman legions besieged that great fortress of Masada, and they committed mass suicide rather than be taken into captivity. So the one thing that all this melange of competing sects in the Jewish world had agreed about was the temple. That was important, and the regular cycle of sacrifices that went on there to God. But now the Romans had destroyed the temple too. So that really was the end and destruction of the centre of the Jewish world. What happened after that, the Synod of Jaffna, was that the Pharisees, a minority party and a minority option, seized the high ground in Jewish religious opinion and recast the Jewish religion in a completely different shape and form. What we now know as Judaism in the modern world is what they created after this catastrophe. So, those words of Jesus are, first of all, practical advice about how to survive in this apocalyptic scenario at the end of the Jewish world. Don't get sucked in by the hotheads who started all this trouble. Don't cooperate with the men of violence. Don't panic while everybody else is losing their heads. Make your way to a place of safety. Avoid any contact with the men of violence. And as it says in the Gospel reading today, he will send his angels to gather in his elect from the four corners of the earth and the four corners of heaven. This providential God will watch over you, because you will become what the temple was. You will become the centerpiece of God's designs for the world. You are what really matters. And this is why Paul could look back on the creation of those modest-sized Christian communities around the Mediterranean world, because they were where the action really was in God's eyes, despite the rise and fall of empires and what politicians and generals and economists were getting up to. This was where God's attention was particularly focused. And these words from the Gospel broaden out and look to what we call a theology of history, which says that the human story has a beginning, a middle, and an end, and God will be at the end there to greet us, to fulfill this story. It will be an ultimately happy ending. God's in control. This vigilant God watches over his church and his providential designs. In that sense, history is what Martin Buber called a dialogue between God and humankind. The human story evolves through this dialogue of proposition and counterproposition, and it reveals a God with an astounding capacity to overcome even human rejection and no's to him. As an example of his astounding tactical agility, the very descent of the Holy Spirit at Pentecost and the creation of the church thereby is God's way to open up a new offer of salvation to the human race after the rejection and death of the Son. The church is a providentially arranged second chance option for the human race, the all aboard salvation community, to give people an opportunity now to be drawn into union with God. And that's why the church really matters. God's general grace is available to all the human race, powerfully working for their good, but his particular grace is focused on the life of the church as the all aboard salvation second chance opportunity. In that sense, God's like a master novelist, developing the plot lines, developing the characters until they reach a satisfying stage of final development to him, to themselves, and to the readers. And in a sense, our rejections and misunderstandings of him are the tension that makes the plot interesting. How the story ends, only God knows. But no matter how many chapters this story involves, no matter how many sad tales are told along the way, it's an ultimately happy ending because God is the power of the future. Spoken in the name of God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit.